This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Richard Harris, sitting in for Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking about a new event called the World Science Festival. Up first, a new climate report out this week puts the focus on the U.S. Some climate reports, like the ones from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, are broad in scope. They detail the impacts of climate change and options for adaptation and mitigation on a global scale. Well, this new report looks at how global warming is affecting us here in the U.S. It documents changes that are already taking place in the areas of agriculture, land and water resources, and biodiversity. It also makes predictions for the near future, that's 25 to 50 years out. It's a government report out from the U.S. Climate Change Science Program. It's written by authors from 13 federal agencies, universities, national labs, and other organizations that are outside the government. We'll start the hour today talking about our climate future with one of the lead authors of the report. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now let me introduce my guest. Peter Backlund is Director of Research Relations at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. He's an author on the new climate report. He joins me today by phone from his office in Boulder. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Well, we've been hearing a lot about climate change from scientists and economists and other blue ribbon panels over the last couple of years. What's the point of your new report?
Well, it's a bit different than most of the recent reports, particularly those from the IPCC, in that it's the first really extensive look at how climate might affect the U.S. that's been done in about 8 years. And the time frame of the report is quite a bit different from other analyses. We've focused very much on the recent past and the next 20 to 50 years, as opposed to the longer range kind of 100-year projections that are more typical in most work.
Why so? Why did you focus on a shorter time frame?
Two main reasons. One is that the shorter time frame is more relevant to people that have to make decisions about natural resource management and things like that. The other reason is that our view is that the climate changes that are going to occur in the next, say, 2 to 4 decades are somewhat better understood than longer-term projections because much of the change that we're going to experience is based on emissions that have already occurred. So the coming changes are somewhat less uncertain in the near term.
You're saying that the climate will change regardless of what actions we take in the next couple decades?
Yes. The IPCC and other groups, including my own lab here, have done a series of projections that look at what would happen to climate if CO2 emissions were curtailed almost immediately, and we're still facing very substantial climate change, mainly because of the heat that's been stored in the oceans and will be released over that time, and because of the long atmospheric lifetime of CO2. Hmm. So we're facing a pretty substantial climate commitment, regardless of any emission mitigation actions that we take in the near term.
Yeah. And if we could cut to the quick, what did you find as sort of the takeaway message of what you discovered in this report?
Well, there's a few things that I would emphasize. One is that we've identified a very wide range of climate impacts that are already occurring across all the sectors that we examined. Also related to what we were just talking about, we believe that these impacts will continue to occur over the next, 2 to 4 decades, regardless of emissions limitation actions. So adaptation is really a necessity. Another thing that we are quite worried about is that we see a lot of potential change in ecosystem services, but we don't really have enough knowledge of the way that climate is affecting ecosystems to project how those changes will affect the way that ecosystems provide services to us. And by services, I mean things like clean water and actually the removal of carbon from the atmosphere.
Trees soaking up carbon dioxide, stuff like that.
Exactly. They provide substantial benefits doing that right now. They're limiting the amount of climate change we're seeing. But the question is how that's going to change as temperatures continue to increase in the next few decades.
Huh. If you had to point to one finding that was most alarming or concerning to you, what would that be?
I think the one that really jumped out at me did have to do with forests, and it is the very large increase in the number and severity of forest fires and insect pest outbreaks that we're experiencing right now that are definitely related closely to climate change. We're having, very large forest fires, as everyone who watches the news can see. But we're also having these insect outbreaks that are very serious. In Colorado, we are having mountain pine beetles that are just exploding in the forest on the western slope and starting to come over onto the eastern slope as well. The lodgepole pine forest is experiencing mortality of 30 to up to 90% in some areas. And this is happening because the warmer, less wet conditions have increased the vulnerability of the trees, and the warmer conditions have also removed a natural limitation on the spread of the beetles because we're not getting enough cold weather in the winter to inhibit their spread.
So frost used to kill them off, is that?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Usually you need about 10 days of really cold sub-zero weather to kill off the beetles, and we've had quite a few winters where we haven't had those conditions, so they're spreading much more rapidly than previously.
Mm. Yeah, one item that you spent some time on in the report has to do with water resources. We know that there's been a drought fairly extensively in the southwestern United States. Do you attribute that to human-induced climate change?
It's likely that human-induced climate change is playing a role in that. I wouldn't specifically say that the exact southwestern drought is due to climate change, but over the last century, the Southwest has become quite a bit drier, as the Southeast, for instance, in some areas in the East, have become wetter. The projections from the models all show that the Southwest is liable to become quite a bit drier, and in fact, this is one of the impacts that we're very, very concerned about.
Yeah, and anything you can do about it once you have this knowledge? Does that help you say, I don't suppose you can prevent a drought, but can you change the way you handle water resources, for example?
Well, we think that there are a number of things that can be done. Our report does not focus on evaluating or identifying adaptation options, but we've certainly, I think, have produced a lot of information relevant to that. In the case of water management, what's going to have to happen is we're going to have to change to more of an anticipatory system that relies more on projections and model-based work as opposed to past practices, which really relied very much on looking at the past records of climate as a proxy for the future. What's happening is we're finding that the past really is not a good indicator of future conditions, and so some of the water management practices are going to have to change. The community that deals with that is very creative, but this is going to be a large challenge for them.
Yeah, I guess one question is, are these findings, are you confident enough in these findings to be able to tell somebody, we know this is going to happen and you should spend a lot of time and effort building dams or whatever they need to do? I mean, are you sure that you're going to be right about that, or could they be wasting their time and effort and maybe addressing the wrong problems?
We consider it very likely that these changes are going to happen in the West. And in fact, at my own lab and other places, we're already interacting with water managers, trying to help them devise some of these modeling tools that will help to manage their way through the climate change challenge.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let's go to the phones and take some questions. Our number here is 1-800-989-TALK. Please give us a call. And let's take a call here. Let's start with Joe from Fair Oaks, California. Joe, hello.
Hi. When you're talking about I have two points, one near-term, one long-term. One, in California, I looked at the heating and cooling index, cooling days in California, and I see over the last 15 years that there's almost no change. A few more cooling days required, but on the average, not much change. And along with that, Mount Shasta is reporting the more glacier and more snow than ever before. And my long-term point is between 400 and 1100, we had the medieval cooling period where we had the warming period, where we know that the Europe experienced extreme warm climates. They had grapes growing in the northern part of Europe, which had never grown before. You know, what caused that? And isn't that related? And it's probably more warming than today. So how do you explain that in terms of our current global warming?
Well, I would address that in two ways. First of all, with regards to your first point, there's a lot of texture to climate change, and regional and global trends don't necessarily translate into the exact same thing happening at a particular spot. So it's certainly true that a particular range or a mountain or an area might get more snow, but the overall trend, certainly in California and in the Pacific Northwest, is towards somewhat more rain and somewhat less snow and earlier runoff in the spring. And this is one of these factors that's challenging the water managers. and this has been quite conclusively attributed to human-induced climate change. With regard to the kind of medieval warm period, you're bringing up a very important point, which is that human-induced climate change is an overlay on a background of a very substantial natural variability. And there are cycles in the Earth system, in particular the Pacific Decadal Oscillation has a big effect on California, where, you know, there are warming and cooling events that happen naturally. Superimposed on that, though, we're seeing a very clear signal of human-induced warming from the increase of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And this is very well understood physics, and it's been confirmed by observations and a very wide-ranging set of analyses.
Right. I think your report did show that you saw cooling in some places and warming in others, and obviously that on the whole, dramatic warming in Alaska and places like that. But global warming didn't necessarily mean every place is getting hotter all the time.
It's one of the things that makes it so complex and such exciting science, frankly, to work on, is that there are so many factors that affect the climate, and then there are so many factors in addition to climate that affect ecosystems. This is one of the things that makes it very challenging.
Yeah. Let me ask you one last question, which is about do we have all the right data to really understand this? Or do we have all the right satellites in place? Or do we really understand, looking ahead well enough, everything we need to know to really make good, firm projections and so on?
We're actually quite concerned about the state of the observations. A lot has been learned about climate essentially by piecing together observations from many different systems designed for other things, primarily weather forecasting. These systems aren't really optimized to produce climate information. And so our sense is that we're getting a very good sense of the big picture, but we're missing a lot of the details. And we're very concerned, because of the complexity of the issue, that the details are really what matters. So yeah. We would like to see some improvements in observing systems, all the way from satellites down to ground-based systems. But we also feel that it's very important to have some improvements in the modeling capabilities to take that observational data and analyze it and ultimately begin to forecast ecological conditions in much the same way that we do weather.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I'd like to thank Peter Backlund, Director of Research Relations at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. We'll be right back after the short break. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Richard Harris, in for Ira Flatow. What do actor Alan Alda, Columbia University string theorist Brian Greene, and Muppet scientist Dr. Bunsen Honeydew have in common? Well, they're all part of the World Science Festival, underway this week in New York City. It's a new event, and the idea is to bring science to the public through dozens of events across the city. Interested in sustainable cities, endangered species, how our genes determine our identities, the weird world of quantum physics? Well, the festival's got it covered. For the rest of the hour, we'll get a virtual tour of the festival with one of its co-founders, and we'll talk with two winners of a brand new award in science, the Kavli Prize. Those were handed out this week at the festival's World Science Summit for achievements in astrophysics, nanoscience, and neuroscience. If you'd like to join in, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guest. Brian Greene is co-founder of the World Science Festival. He's author of The Elegant Universe, Superstrings, Hidden Dimensions, and the Quest for the Ultimate Theory, and The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. And he's a professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University here in New York. He joins me today in the Science Friday studio. Welcome back, Dr. Greene.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
So festival sounds festive to me. It's not a word that a lot of people would associate with science, I'd say. But so tell me, why are you doing this?
The idea is to really try to shift the public's perception of science so that they don't see it as cold and intimidating and aloof, something that makes your head hurt, but rather something like great literature, music, or art that enriches your life, that gives you a connection to your surroundings that's hard to achieve in any other way. So the point is to make science exciting and accessible, not watering it down, but really allow people to engage with the underlying ideas.
And how did this idea come about?
Well, I was asked to speak at the Genoa Science Festival. Europe has some of these science festivals. We don't. And I went there in 2005. together with Tracy Day, who's a broadcast journalist, and we stood in this square in this little town of Genoa, and science was kind of spilling out into the streets. People were so excited about it. There was an electric sense of science in the atmosphere. And we stood there and said, wouldn't it be spectacular to do something like this in New York, where perhaps for a few days science would become the headliner, science would be the main act, and people would be thinking about science, going to science, and really helping to shift science to the center of the public conversation. And we decided then to try to do it.
Yeah, so how do you do it? Van de Graaff generators throwing out sparks or things like that? I mean, that's sort of the flashy version of science, but there must be a...
Not really. Yeah. You know, our view is, or I should say mine personally is, it is useful for kids in particular to blow things up and to have sparks, and all that is good, but that's not really what the heart of science is. And it kind of limits your capacity to bring people into science if you limit it to bangs and booms and things like that. So we are really taking serious science, cosmology, quantum physics, neuroscience, sustainability, and creating programming that is really quite compelling, accessible and entertaining, but the science is really there in a significant way. So there are kids' programs. I don't want to downplay that at all, but there's a broad spectrum of adult programs where things don't blow up at all, but yet the programs are really quite wonderful.
Give a couple for instances.
Well, last night I went to a program of ours called Illuminating Genius, and the idea of the program is to bring together artists and neuroscientists to try to have a conversation that teases out where creativity sits in the brain. Is it something that can be cultivated? Is it something that is obviously in the architecture of the brain? So Bill T. Jones was there, Matthew Ritchie, neuroscientist Ramachandran was there, David Eagleman, another neuroscientist, Nancy Andreasen, and Michael York did a performance piece to start it all off. And it was a real vibrant conversation at this interface between the creative arts and neuroscientists who are beginning to look in the brain with medical imaging devices and beginning to get a sense of where that creative spark is.
And who's coming? Who's your audience?
It's a little hard for me to put my finger on it because there are so many people there. We've been so gratified that basically every event has sold out. Last night in this theater, there were 900 people there, and just looking at them roughly, there was quite an age range. There were students there. There were older members of the audience as well. Certainly there were people who I recognize as coming from the science community, but others who I certainly didn't. I'm sure they're just from the general populace. So it's really trying to reach a broad spectrum of the general public.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know if you're drawing in people who aren't naturally drawn to these events. I mean, that presumably is your goal.
Yes, and we will know that. We're doing extensive surveying of the individuals. The data hasn't yet been compiled, but we're having people fill out forms that give us a sense of where they're coming from and how the event may have affected the way they think about science. For instance, whether they'd be a little more apt to read the Science Times because of an event, or pick up a science book, or follow up on a subject that they heard about in an event. So we will get a sense of that shortly, but I have already spoken to a few of our data folks, and they have indicated that we are finding that kind of traction, where people are saying, yeah, I didn't really think about science in those terms before, and it's really something that I would want to continue to pursue.
How many of the events are free, and how many people have to pay to get into?
Well, some of the events are free. In the Kids and Family program, there is an all-day street fair that takes place at Washington Square Park on Saturday, May 31st, rain or shine, all day from 10 to 6, and it looks like it's going to rain, so we'll have to see what that looks like. But there's some wonderful things there. Disney is coming with a 12-foot-tall animatronic dinosaur that will be walking around, and they'll give people a sense of how it works, the science behind it. You got a magic school bus for the younger kids. Miss Frizzle will be walking around. Snook, are you familiar with Snook?
No, I don't know Snook.
Yeah, Snook is this 8-foot-tall sloth, the PBS character who has science in his programming. So that's free. And then the remainder of the programs are largely paid, but we've really extended a great effort to keep the cost down so it's widely accessible. For instance, Disney's doing a paid programming where they're going to show the science behind robotics, virtual reality, animation, things of that sort. And it's a $12 program for anybody who wants to attend.
Well, let's go to the phones. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-989-TALK. And let's say hello to Andrew from Chicago. Hello, Andrew.
This is Andrew.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, wonderful. How are you gentlemen doing?
Great. How are you?
Fantastic, as always. Just got a quick question for just on my mind here. I'm looking at a wonderful sky, and it's raining, and I'm just thinking, listening to your conversation, how can I be of service just as a regular human being who wants to take action to create this movement?
Movement in terms of more appreciation for science? Is that what you're
talking about? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even beyond that, making it a part of your life by finding a balance between technology and nature.
Huh. Ryan Green, do you have an idea?
Well, sure. It's a great question, and it all depends on what kind of impact one wants to have. I think at the level of the individual, if you are taking in science and making it an integral part of your life, I think that's the start. If everybody were to do that, we would be in a completely different place in this country. So I think that's the most important thing. But if one wants to have a broader impact, one of the great things that started happening lately in a variety of cities are these cafe sciences. I don't know how much you're familiar with those, where scientists from universities or from research laboratories go to a local restaurant or bar or pub and sit there and just talk to people without PowerPoint, without visuals, about science. So if you can organize that kind of a gathering in your community, it's the kind of thing where people would really just come out and experience science in a very informal way, and I think they're very effective.
Great. Well, thanks. Yeah, those cafes, do they attract an audience? Have you gone to them?
I have gone to them. I did one myself, a version of one down in Texas not too long ago, and they do attract a pretty broad audience because it's not often that you have that kind of informal exchange with scientists, and I think it's something which people find very valuable. Mm-hmm.
Was it hard for you to sell this idea, to get funding to do it and to get it off the ground?
Well, it's always a lot of work to get funding, as anybody in the nonprofit sector knows all too well. But when we road tested this idea with university presidents, we went to Lee Bollinger at Columbia, John Sexton at NYU, Paul Nurse at Rockefeller, Matthew Goldstein at CUNY, George Campbell at Cooper Union, the universal reaction was, this is such a really good idea. We can't believe it doesn't already exist in this country. We're in the century of science. How could we not have a gathering that celebrates science? I mean, when you look at the film industry, there are like over 100 film festivals throughout the United States every year, and not a single science festival. It kind of doesn't add up. It doesn't really make sense. So just about everybody we brought this idea to, from the universities to the cultural institutions to the government, we went to New York City government, Dan Doctoroff, we told him about this idea, immediately said, yes, this is something that has to happen, you know, the state as well. So everybody really, really came behind it in a very strong way, and we're very, very happy about that.
Hmm. And what made you say you're willing to put aside your work in cosmology for a little while to devote yourself to this? What makes it so important for you?
Well, it is very important to me. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, which is probably a good thing when it comes to some projects, because it took a lot, much more time and more effort than I ever anticipated that it would. But I think it's so critical to have a general public that is engaged with science. When we look at the challenges and opportunities just around the corner, or with us already, climate change, stem cells, genomic sequencing, nanotechnology, space travel, alternate energies, I mean, there's so many issues that we have to ultimately make some decisions about. And they're fundamentally scientific. So if you have a general public that isn't engaged with the science, that it can't really engage with the ideas and make informed decisions. So it's so important that people are not intimidated by these ideas. And the other side, of course, is kids. You know, to get kids excited about science, what could be more important than that?
Let's take another call here. Let's talk to Bob in Lombard, Illinois. Bob, I hope I've pushed the right button. Can you hear me?
Yes, hello.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I understand there's an alternative to the string theory, and I'm wondering what that is and where I can find out about it. I'm very interested in theory, but my math is a little limited.
First of all, did string theory come up at the festival?
There is a program that's called Beyond Einstein that I believe happens on Saturday. And it is an exploration of how far we've gotten along the path toward Einstein's dream of a unified theory of all of physics, a single theory that might describe the big, the small, everything in between with maybe a single equation or a single master principle. String theory is one approach to finding that unified theory, and there have been other approaches to putting together the big and the small, gravity and quantum mechanics in the form of something called loop quantum gravity. Lee Smolin is one of the proponents, and he has some popularizations of that that people can read. And there are others as well, dynamical triangulations. I don't know if there are any popular level books on that subject, but there are a number of approaches that are out there, which is great. The health of a field is the number of different avenues of approach that people are following to try to find the answers.
I'm Richard Harris, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So you're going to, I guess, let's talk a little bit about the festival more. You kicked it off on earlier this week. Was it Wednesday?
Wednesday, that's right.
And it started with the World Science Summit, right?
Yes. I
was talking to Brian Green here, by the way. Tell us about the World Science Summit.
So the World Science Summit is a somewhat different character from the rest of the World Science Festival programming in that it's not open to the general public. This was a closed-door, invitation-only gathering among some of the top scientists in the world. There are about 10 Nobel laureates there, other leading scientists as well, together with leaders in business and government, in order to have a conversation in which science is really brought in at every level to the ideas of how to make a decision about various policy issues. So the focus was on sustainability, foreign policy, and also on more science at the level of the individual. It was called Building a Better Brain, the issues surrounding how, for instance, brain-machine interface can really change the way in which we go about doing our everyday business. So it was a real exciting gathering. And out there also, we had an announcement of the Kavli Prize winners, the first annual, every other year prize that has been set up in Norway, sort of Norway's answer to Sweden, which has the Nobel Prizes.
Well, tell me about the Kavli Prizes.
So the Kavli Prizes, it comes from the vision of Fred Kavli, who has been enormously supportive to science in the last few years, setting up wonderful institutes in a variety of universities. And the prizes are awarded in the fields of astrophysics, cosmology, in neuroscience, and in nanoscience. And each of the prizes is $1 million, so it's a significant prize. And the inaugural version of these prizes was announced at this World Science Summit on Wednesday.
Hmm. And in fact, we have one of those prize winners with us joining us on the phone. Louis Bruce is a winner of the 2008 Kavli Prize in Nanoscience. At work, he's the Samuel Latham Mitchell Professor of Chemistry and Professor of Chemical Engineering at Columbia University in New York, where you are also, as well. And congratulations and welcome to the program, Dr. Bruce.
Well, thank you so much.
So I gather you were awarded this prize for something called quantum dots. Do you want to help connect the dots for us? What are quantum dots?
Well, they're very small pieces of semiconductor that are basically halfway on their way to being molecules. This work that it began more than 20 years ago now was an effort to understand what would happen to transistors or to the design of a transistor when dimensions became very small. I think everyone knows that computers are more and more powerful because the transistor is getting smaller every year. But at some point, that would change when the pieces of the transistor, the silicon itself, would begin to look and act more like a molecule rather than a semiconductor, just because the number of atoms was getting to be smaller and smaller.
Yeah, so the property of the material actually changes just as it approaches some sort of atomic limits, is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So it's basically when it would behave more like a molecule, like a subject in chemistry rather than a subject in physics. So we tried to work out that transformation from chemistry to physics on an intellectual level, but also on a practical level, a synthetic level, actually making these particles and using them as components for new materials. Things of that sort.
Yeah. So what can you do with them?
Well, basic research is really unpredictable, and we were thinking all the time about transistor design and how to modify transistors, but the first application actually comes in biology. And these small particles emit light very well, just like semiconductor is an excellent emitter of light. We use light-emitting diodes all the time. We have solid-state street lighting that's just coming, to be practical. And so these particles have now been used to image, to provide luminescent images for processes occurring inside the cell.
I never thought
of that, but people read the articles that we published, and they made the connection. They had a problem to be solved, and they understood that, this thing that we had discovered might be the solution. And so that's now become an industry of, it's used widely in biological imaging.
That sounds interesting. we will and what other than biological imaging can you do with it?
Well, there's a big effort right now to by physical scientists of my sort to address the energy problem, which is
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt you. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Richard Harris. We're talking this hour about the World Science Festival. My guests are Brian Green, co-founder of the World Science Festival and author of The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos. He's a professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University in New York. Also with us is Lewis Bruce, winner of the 2008 Kavli Prize in Nanoscience and a professor of chemistry and chemical engineering at Columbia University in New York. And Dr. Bruce, we were talking a little bit about quantum dots, and you were starting to tell us about some of the other things that can be used for.
Yes. One thing that's happening right now is that people are trying to use quantum dots to design new types of solar cells. Electricity in this country is principally generated by the burning of coal, and that's quite cheap, but actually quite polluting to the atmosphere in terms of release of carbon dioxide. And a wonderful permanent solution that many people envisage on the timescale of 50 years is to replace this with solar electricity, with solar cells. And we have solar cells now, but and they're made out of silicon, but they're actually quite expensive, and that limits their use. And so there's a tremendous effort underway to find a way to make cheaper solar cells that can be used everywhere. And the quantum dots may well turn out to be an integral part of this. And that research is going on right now in many laboratories in many countries around the world.
Wow. That would certainly be a major accomplishment if you could make solar inexpensive and readily accessible.
Yeah, so something like that is the product of many different people with many different ideas at different times and places, you know, and a group effort. Hmm.
Let's go to the phones here. There's a call here from John in Cambridge, Massachusetts. John, please, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me on. I wanted, if I could, just to come back to the issue of the World Science Festival and to the issue of science festivals in general in the United States. I wanted to just tell you that actually the situation isn't quite as bad on the ground as maybe it sounded a few minutes ago. There are already science festivals beginning here, and we in Cambridge have had one for the last 2 years, actually. We just finished our second one. Last year, Science Friday actually came and broadcast from our festival. We're wishing and hoping all the best for our friends in New York with their World Science Festival. But there are about three other cities we know of which are also waiting in the wings, just about to start there. So I think we're on the verge of something really big here.
That's great. And I should, considering your accent, I guess I should mention you're calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I am. I'm sorry. I'm a Brit, but actually I live here. I work at MIT, and it's the Cambridge, Massachusetts Science Festival I'm talking about.
Uh-huh. So do you have advice for Brian Green and the New York?
Oh, I'm not sure I would try to give Brian advice on this. It sounds to me like he's been preparing in depth and very carefully. I wish him all the very best. I mean, what we have found is that you can begin to build interest year on year, and I hope very much that he's intending to make his an annual effort. And I'd be interested to know what his plan, if he dare look beyond what he's currently preoccupied with, what his plans for 2009 and beyond may be.
Neil, we're definitely planning this as an annual event, and what you're pointing out is so exciting because we envisage that there really can be a movement sparked where people think about science in a vastly different way, and having science festivals, I'd love it to happen in every city throughout the United States. I'd love it to happen in every city throughout the world, because there should be a nationwide, there should be a worldwide celebration every year of science, because it's the thing that is the most profound element in shaping and molding the future.
Well, I absolutely agree with that, Brian, and I can say for sure we know that San Diego is now well advanced in planning to start a festival on the West Coast in 2009, and I know that there's real interest in San Francisco, Philadelphia, and St. Louis, to name just three other cities. So I see no reason why between us all we can't really begin to get something big happening here.
Sounds like a movement. Well, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
All right. Now joining us as well on the phone is Thomas Jessel. He's another winner of the 2008 Kavli Prize. This one is in neuroscience. He's the Claire Toe Professor in Neuroscience and Biochemistry and Molecular Biophysics at the Center for Neurobiology and Behavior at Columbia University Medical Center in New York. Congratulations to you, Dr. Jessel, and welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And tell us why your work was recognized.
Well, I think it was a recognition of an entire field of developmental neuroscience and its relation to the way in which nerve cells form circuits that control behaviors in invertebrate organisms. And so, as you know, the human brain contains many, many billions of nerve cells with thousands of different cell types. And in order to control any aspect of bodily function, these nerve cells have to wire themselves into networks or circuits that exhibit remarkable precision. And the precision of those circuits eventually ends up controlling the behavior. And so we, as with many other people in the field, have been interested in how nerve cells become different and how those differences defined at a molecular level enable those nerve cells or neurons to form selective circuits and to understand the way in which the logic of circuit assembly and organization controls a particular behavior.
And what's the ultimate purpose of this?
The ultimate purpose, I think, is to understand enough about the wiring of the nervous system, not only to be able to explain normal aspects of behavior, but to understand pathologies of the nervous system, why some nerve cells degenerate in neurological disorders, why subtle differences in the wiring produce psychiatric diseases, and the only way forward in trying to approach those major issues is to understand the normal process with which one can then begin to tackle what has gone wrong in these disease states.
Right. The other thing that people are always hopeful for is something that would approach the problem of spinal damage. Is that something you're thinking about as well?
Yes, that's uppermost in our mind in the sense that most of the studies we've done are focused on the spinal cord. And so the issue is how after a motorcycle accident, when you sever the connections between the brain and the spinal cord, you can restore motor function. And over the last 5 to 10 years, there have been really dramatic advances in understanding not the process of regeneration, but the blocks to regeneration. And so now scientists can begin in a systematic way to overcome those blocks and to gradually improve the prospects for recovery.
That sounds like a much desired goal, but it also sounds like it might be a ways off.
It's a challenge. And so even though over the last 10 to 20 years there have really been profound advances in our understanding of the way the nervous system assembles and functions, we are still some way off from having a practical cure to degenerative diseases or to spinal cord injury. But nevertheless, I think there's a sense of optimism in the field now that these are not impossible goals and that with these systematic, rational approaches, within years, at most, perhaps a decade or two, there will be rational solutions to some of these issues.
I'd like to ask you what it was like to win a major new prize that no one had ever won before. How did you find out? How did you feel about it?
The overriding element, I think, was initially of surprise. We found out there was a phone call from the Norwegian Academy of Sciences at some antisocially early hour on Wednesday morning. And things have been a bit of a blur since then. So there was both surprise, delight, but also a sense that it's really an entire field or discipline of science that is being recognized. And because this is a new prize, I think perhaps it sets in some way a precedent for the types of awards in neuroscience and nanoscience that Fred Kavli has been so visionary in trying to pursue.
Yes, and Professor Bruce, how about you? Do you have what was your story about hearing about the prize?
Well, it was 6:50 a.m. in the morning, and I was just getting out of bed when this phone call came, and it was quite a shock. You know, I had forgotten completely about the fact that this prize had existed, and all of Wednesday was a blur. And I learned for the first time what it is to stand in front of a live television camera and to speak without a script or speak in any sort of a way. And, you know, I would echo this point that I just represent the field. There are you know, many, many strong people who have made independent contributions to this area of quantum dots and nanocrystals, and I sort of symbolize this field, but I'm just one worker in the field.
So I guess the prize is $1 million, but it will be shared among people in each category, I gather. Do you?
Yes, I'm sharing it with Professor Ejima, Sumio Ejima in Japan, who made quite a significant discovery in the structure of carbon nanotubes in the early 1990s, and that's very well deserved.
So sounds as though a party could be in your future. If
yes, without a doubt.
That's fantastic. And Dr. Jessel, do you, I mean, a windfall like that must be something you think about a little bit before you decide what to do about it, but have you given it any thought at all?
Given the events of the last couple of days, I can't really say that this has been uppermost. I mean, again, I would just echo that I'm sharing this prize, and an added pleasure in this is that the two people I'm sharing it with, Sten Grillner from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden and Pashko Rakic from Yale, are colleagues who I have admired for many, many years. And although we haven't worked directly together, I think collectively the types of problems we've been approaching have been similar in scope. So it's a particular, it's a lot of fun to share this or share the prospect of this with those two.
Well, let's go back to the phones for a call. Let's talk to John in San Pablo, California. John, welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon. I thank you for answering my call. I've had an experience about opening up my creativity, or a.k.a. Inspiration. I was an engineer for 18 years, a geotechnical. I've worked around the world. And then I became a nurse aide. And I was in nursing school, and my first patient as a nursing student was catatonic, frozen arms, frozen legs, eyes open, but no cognition. I was supposed to, I gave him a bath, I put him on a gurney, and I started with his little finger. I said, you're not showing recognition that you hear or understand me, but let's start with your little finger.
John, I'm not quite sure where this question is going.
This question is going to the creativity of scientists, artists, and everybody, how to open up that area such that you are available to make discoveries in nanotechnology, et cetera, including the science and all areas.
Yeah, well,
that's
an interesting question. Brian Green, do you think that does science just sort of happen from a cookbook? I mean, that's how kids tend to learn it in school. But, I mean, where is the element of creativity?
Well, it's at the heart of science. And one of the things that I always feel really disappointed about is when I do encounter kids who think that science is simply the stuff that they learn in their class, the stuff that's in their textbook. Because we present the end product in the textbook, we don't show the journey of science. Science is this spectacular journey of discovery, this mysterious universe that we're trying to figure out, and it takes inspiration, it takes creativity, it takes familiarity with the underlying technical details so that you can funnel that creativity through the right language for describing the universe. But relativity, quantum mechanics, these were astonishing leaps of creative insight by some of the greatest geniuses that our planet has ever known.
I'm Richard Harris, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So that may explain then why you have artists as well as scientists at your at the World Science Festival.
Yeah, well, the other way of thinking about it is we realize that you need to create new avenues of entry into science for people. I mean, there's some people who just would never go near science, regardless of how you describe it, but they might go to dance or they might go to film. So why not have dance or film or theater or art that has an organic connection to science? So, for instance, at the Guggenheim Museum Friday and Saturday, a wonderful choreographer, Carol Armitage, is interpreting quantum gravity, string theory, through choreography. So, you know, gravity is integral to dance, it's integral to string theory. Put them together and see what comes out. Huh. So these are the ways in which people would come in, as Tracy Day, our executive director, likes to say, they come in for the art and they leave with the science.
Huh. Well, that sounds like fun. Let's take another call. Let's talk to Christy in Maynard, Massachusetts. Christy, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I'm loving this discussion. I worked at the Museum of Science in Boston for 13 years and then went into teaching science in a classroom. So I've been in the trenches, and I've seen where the stumbling blocks are, and I'm so excited about these festivals. And I'm wondering, I think a major stumbling block for people is the difference between science and technology. And I even hear it in your discussions, you go back and forth between the questions of science and the questions of technology, of how this neuroscience applies. And I think it's a critical difference for people to understand. And I just wonder if you address that at these festivals.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great point. And what we really try to do in a number of the programs is allow people to recognize how the technology that they are familiar with is actually based on fundamental science. So there's a link there that can really get people excited about science, because everybody has a cell phone or a personal computer, but how many people recognize that those devices work because of quantum physics? Quantum physics is what allows the integrated circuit to exist, and the integrated circuit is what allows the cell phone and the personal computer and all sorts of medical technology to exist. And when you say to someone, you have a quantum mechanical device in your pocket, and when you push its buttons, you are manipulating the quantum mechanical devices within it, they're like, wow, okay, I'm interested in quantum physics, then tell me about it, as opposed to it feeling completely esoteric.
Huh, that's great.
Right. I also noticed that because the line is so blurred, that when certain technologies, say, genetic engineering of food or something like that, people condemn science for it, which is just a quest for understanding the natural world and asking those questions. And so it's almost like there's a backlash against science because of a technology.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks very much for your call. I want to, before we get out of here, I want to ask Professors Bruce and Jessel, are you planning to go to any of the events at the World Science Festival here in New York City?
Yeah, this is Tom Jessel here. I've already enjoyed many of the events earlier in the week, and it's really inspiring, as Brian mentioned, to see the variety of participants, topics under discussion. I went, and the first person I ran into was a high school teacher at my daughter's high school. So I think if the intent of the festival is to reach out not just to technicians and professionals in the field, but attract people who have the important job of encouraging enthusiasm in science in the young, then it's really doing a marvelous job at achieving that.
Indeed. Dr. Bruce?
Yes, I think the festival has been a great success. On Wednesday, I heard a marvelous discussion of our energy policy and the constraints and the possibilities for future research, and participated in this discussion. So it's been one outstanding event after another.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for joining us. I'd like to thank Brian Green, co-founder of the World Science Festival and author of the books The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos. He's a professor of mathematics and physics at Columbia University in New York. Louis Bruce is winner of the 2008 Kavli Prize in Nanoscience and a chemistry professor at Columbia University. And Professor Thomas Jessel is a winner of the 2008 Kavli Prize in Neuroscience and a neurobiologist in Columbia. I'm Richard Harris, Science Friday. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Richard Harris, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Up first, the odd story of a gene thief. You inherited your genes from your parents. I inherited my genes from mine. That's what makes us human. But next, we're going to hear about an animal that actually steals its genes from other species. The animal is a tiny swimming invertebrate called a rotifer. And it turns out that these animals swipe genes from yeast. They swipe genes from bacteria. They even swipe genes from plants. You could say these critters are picking fruit from the other branches of the tree of life. Matthew Methelson from Harvard University discovered this bizarre behavior. He wrote about it in Science magazine this week, and he joins us by phone from Paris. Welcome, Professor Methelson.
Good evening. Actually, the work was done by a postdoctoral fellow, Irina Arkhipova, and a graduate student, Eugene Ladishev, in my laboratory. We first became interested in these little animals, which are called delloid rotifers, because of asking the question, why does it take two parents to produce one offspring? Why can't just one parent do it? And the answer is there are lots of plants and animals that do it that way, but they go extinct after evolutionarily short periods of time. But there's one group of animals, that reproduce. There are no males, no hermaphrodites. They're all females. They lay eggs, which have not gone extinct. They've been around for maybe 100 million years. So if you're interested in this very deep evolutionary problem of why it takes two to make an offspring instead of just one,
right.
Delaware rotifers are the thing to study.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about
they're amazing in many ways. They were discovered by von Leeuwenhoek, the microscope person, in 1702 because he added water to the dust from the rain gutter of his house, and these little animals came up from this perfectly dry dust. He wrote a letter to the Royal Society about it and sent a package of the dust to them. They still have that dust in London.
Really?
So they're famous because they can be desiccated. And we believe that all of the very unusual things, the gene stealing that you mentioned, the gene acquisition of foreign genes, the asexuality and being able to succeed without males, and their enormous resistance to ionizing radiation, all depend on this strange ability to be completely dried out and come back to life.
Huh, they sound really tough. What do they look like?
Well, they're small. They're about a 50th of an inch long. They're very beautiful. One of them is called a rosy-colored lover of twirling, or Phyllodina roseola. And they fascinated microscopists since Leeuwenhoek in 1702. They're beautiful little creatures. They live in water. They're extremely abundant. If you take some moss, nearly any moss, put water on it, look at it the next day under a microscope, not even a very high-powered microscope, you almost certainly have some Delaware rotifers there.
Huh. And how long have you been studying them?
Well, about 20 years ago, when I asked an elderly colleague, why does sex exist? And he said, well, you know about the Delaware rotifers. I'd never heard about them, but that's when we began to look at them because of this interest in the question of why it takes two instead of just one to make an offspring.
Yeah. Could you please explain to us how that is the case? Why does two help you so much avoid extinction?
Well, this is one of the major problems in evolutionary biology. There are more than 20 hypotheses to explain it. The answer is there is no general agreement. So we thought that by studying these in the laboratory, maybe we would find out. But it turns out that they, as Irina and Eugene discovered, they can pick up genes from their environment. What we don't know is if they can exchange genes homologously, that is, plug a gene from another rotifer into the same place where that gene was in the parent rotifer, that would be more or less equivalent to sex. What we've published about is not equivalent to sex. It's picking up foreign genes and putting them in a very special place near the ends of the chromosomes. That's not replacing genes in the same place where the corresponding gene used to be.
I see. We're talking to Matthew Methelson from Harvard University, and if you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. We're talking about a small organism that might explain the evolution or something about sex, why sex happens sometimes and why apparently in these organisms it doesn't happen. Now, do you have any idea how recently these organisms have stolen these genes? Could this have been happening a long time ago, or do you think they're sort of cruising through the environment, picking them up as they bump into them?
We have no accurate measure of how recently the most recent ones have been picked up. We think that the older ones have been there for quite a while because they've acquired things called introns, but the short answer is we don't know.
Hmm. And it is amazing to me that they are able to pick them up from all sorts of other animals. How could they get one from a plant, for example?
When they're dried out, these animals, their DNA is all broken up, and their membranes are ruptured, and so foreign DNA could enter. The repair of broken DNA involves, in some cases, the addition of bits of DNA patching between the two pieces or more pieces that are broken. So that may be one way in which the foreign DNA gets in. The next experiment that needs to be done is to find out if they can trade DNA or get DNA from dead rotifers of the same species and have those genes replace their own genes. That would be equivalent to sex. That would be like genetic recombination. They are amazing in another respect. They're enormously resistant to radiation, more than any other animal that has been studied. And this, whatever it is that protects them against radiation, may have important implications for inflammation, for cancer, for aging, for certain neurodegenerative diseases, all things that may be connected with what are called reactive oxygen species that are generated by our metabolism, but also by radiation.
Hmm. Do you think there might be some secrets in there that would help human beings more tolerant of radiation?
Yes, although I don't think human beings need to be more tolerant of radiation, but they do need, perhaps in some cases, to be more tolerant of the oxygen, reactive oxygen molecules that are made normally in our bodies by our energy-producing mitochondria.
I see. Now, some people may recognize your name as somebody from some years ago who was interested in biological weaponry and or not in producing it, but in controlling it, of course. You were famous for recognizing that yellow rain in Vietnam was apparently just bee poop, not a biological attack, for example.
That's right.
And is there any connection between that and what you're studying now, or is it just following your curiosity through science?
No connection at all. Just curiosity.
Very good. Well, it's a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Matthew Messelson is a Thomas Dudley Cabot Professor of Natural Sciences at Harvard University, and he joined us by phone from Paris. Up next, the latest in the search for the perfect prosthetic. Imagine eating dinner with your hands tied behind your back. Not easy to do. But it gives you an idea of the everyday challenges that some paralyzed people face. They have no way of helping themselves to another piece of bread or another shake of salt. But new technology could help those tasks easier. Neurobiologists at the University of Pittsburgh recently gave monkeys the ability to control a robotic arm just by thinking about it. They inserted tiny hair-like electrodes into the monkey's brain that picked up electrical nerve signals from the motor cortex. The monkeys learned that certain thoughts could cause the robot arm to move, and eventually they were able to use the mechanical arm to pick up fruit and, I guess, marshmallows and eat it. Joining me now to talk about the prospects of this technology is Andrew Schwartz. He's a professor of neurobiology at the University of Pittsburgh, and he joins us today in our studio in New York. Welcome to the program, Dr. Schwartz.
Hello, Richard.
If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, you can also go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com. We also have video there of a monkey feeding itself using the robotic arm. So tell me about this. Where did you get the idea that you could sort of tap into the electrical signals in the brain and actually get it to command machinery? Sounds almost science fiction.
Well, this is actually the culmination of work that's been going on for more than 25 years. What we were doing quite a while ago is recording individual neurons and then So neurons are the cells of the brain, and we record activity, the electrical activity, as each one fires. And what we found is that as you move your arm in different direction, these neurons seem to be quite sensitive to that. So each neuron has what we call a preferred direction. It likes to fire in a direction of arm movement. And then once we know which direction each cell likes to fire in, we can add responses from many of these cells together and get a very accurate representation of what the arm movement is.
Hmm. So how many electrodes do you have to do to tap into these signals?
Well, to get a really high fidelity arm trajectory or the path of the arm, it takes about 30 to 100 electrodes recording about that many neurons.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of very detailed work to get this set up.
Well, actually, that's why it's taken about 20 years, is so that we could develop this technology to allow us to record all these cells at the same time.
Right. And I guess you also need the cooperation of the monkeys. What role do they play?
Well, initially we had the monkeys working in what we call open loop conditions, in which they didn't even really know that we were recording from their neurons. And one of the big advances was to close the loop, to give them an indication of what the signal was that we are recording from their brain. And once they did that, they could actually learn to use this device and improve the way their neurons fired.
So to walk us through this experiment, then, how do you train them to associate their thoughts with the movement of an arm? It seems that's hard.
Well, the first thing we had to do was to familiarize them with the whole concept of controlling a tool. In this case, it was a robot arm. And what we had them do was move a joystick back and forth, and that joystick was linked to the movement of the arm. And they learned just by moving the joystick that they could bring food to their mouth. So that gave them the general idea of what we wanted them to do. And then what we did is we implanted these electrodes in their brain and had them basically think about moving the arm. And what we did is we held a piece of food up in front of them, and then we moved the arm for them. And as we did that, we saw that neurons in their brain fired as if they were imagining that they were actually moving that. And once we saw the neurons fire, we knew to recognize those and use those in our control scheme. And then we just proceeded step by step. So first we had the animal move the arm to the vicinity of the food and then stabilize the arm and then learn to close the grip around it and finally to bring the arm back to the mouth.
Ah, and they were rewarded with?
A piece of food, sometimes a zucchini, apples, oranges, marshmallows.
Ah, we'll be right back after this short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Richard Harris. We're talking this hour about monkeys controlling a mechanical arm just by thinking about it. My guest is Andrew Schwartz, a professor of neurobiology at the University of Pittsburgh. And you were saying that it took a lot of steps to get this going. How long did it take you to train the monkeys to actually make the arm work?
Well, that's sort of a tough question to answer because as we were training the monkey, we were also doing a lot of debugging of both our equipment and software. So that ended up taking a few weeks. But I think if we were to do it again right away, now that we have everything fixed, we could probably do it in 2 to 3 days.
Really? That they could learn, they could go through and learn the whole process that quickly?
Well, they could learn the rudimentary aspects of the task. Of course, the more they practice, the better they get.
Right. And how long do the electrodes last in the brain?
Well, right now, one of the monkeys that we implanted has been implanted for 1.5 years, and we're still getting useful signals from the brain.
Hmm. That's a record, or is that unusual to have it that long, or is that sort of typical?
No, but sometimes we've had monkeys last as long as 7 years with electrodes implanted in their brain. The longevities of these electrodes have been increasing over the recent years.
I see, because I understand early on that was a real limitation of the work.
Well, still a limitation in that scar tissue tends to form around these tiny electrodes and then our signal degrades. And actually the signal does get a little worse, but we can still use some aspects of it.
Hmm. Well, let's go to the phones here. Our number is 1-800-989-TALK. Please give us a call and join the conversation. Let's hear from Brian in Lewis, Delaware. Brian, welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just curious if this research is sort of going towards paralysis victims, perhaps, looking at perhaps to do these signals and reconnecting to limbs, any sort of research towards that. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, that's exactly what we're trying to show here. We want to help patients that can't move their arms or that have amputation of the arm. So what we're showing right with this research is that that we can do self-feeding, basically.
Hmm. And there have been some experiments in human beings, right? Well, how do the monkey experiments compare?
So we're using the same exact electrodes that have been implanted in a number of humans, and those humans were able to control cursors in a computer monitor.
I see. So what's the difference between that and the robotic arm?
Well, there's a big difference between working in a computer and working a physical device. This physical device, doesn't work exactly the way we command it to. There's things like marshmallows sticking to the hand or fruit slipping from the gripper. And actually, the monkey has to learn to handle all these conditions.
Right. And when I reach out and touch something, of course, I get feedback from my fingers, and that helps me manipulate whatever I'm holding. Do the monkeys get any kind of feedback from that?
Well, right now, the only feedback the monkeys get is from their vision. As we increase the complexity of the task and start using fingers in a dexterous way, we fully realize that we're going to need to have tactile sensation. And what we hope to do is use sensors in the prosthetic fingers and then take that information and feed it back to the brain and stimulate sensory regions.
Huh. And that's another wiring job. Is that more difficult?
Well, it's going to be another challenge, but hopefully if we start simple, we'll be successful.
Huh. Okay, let's take another call. Let's hear from Arthur in Binghamton, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
All right. Thank you very much for taking my call. I've really enjoyed hearing about the monkey robotic successes that he's been making, and I just wanted to get a bit of a monkey off my own back, and that's about a very serious threat to the Northeast watershed involving the fracturing of gas using the exemption of the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act, which could potentially threaten everything. And wouldn't we be better off putting a robotic monkey's arm down there instead of trying to muck around with threatening the greater watershed like that?
Thanks for your call. It's a little off topic, but I appreciate your calling in. Bye-bye. So tell me about how many other labs are doing this kind of research around the world?
Well, there are a number of other labs doing this similar approach, but what's really exciting is the whole field of what we call neural engineering is just exploding now. This whole idea of linking engineering with basic neuroscience is a really hot topic, and the community is growing explosively.
Hmm. And obviously, you have some very practical endpoints here, but what are you learning about the brain in the process of doing this?
Well, so the technology we've developed allows us to record from a group of neurons simultaneously, and that's much more representative of how the brain really functions. Every time we do anything, there's millions and millions of neurons that change their activity, and the better we can sample that network activity, the better we can understand what's going on. And we're just beginning at very early stages to try to understand the brain from this perspective. And this prosthetic success is an example of that.
Hmm. Any prospect of doing this with essentially remote sensing of the brain, not having to put electrodes into it?
Well, so a number of groups have been trying to do this from outside the brain with EEG, and there has been some limited success. But I think the kind of details we really need to get full prosthetic control is going to require this kind of technology.
Okay, let's take another call. Let's hear from Ryan in Madison, Wisconsin. Ryan, welcome to Talk of the Nation Science Friday.
Yeah, hi. Really, the reason I'm calling, I wasn't exactly forthright with your screener. My call wouldn't have been able to go through. I mean, I know I'm not the only one that's concerned about robots taking over the world, and now there's going to be an unholy alliance with the monkeys controlling them. This is how they get back to us for doing what we've done to the rainforest. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay.
I just don't think this is a great idea. Monkeys controlling robots with their thoughts? Come on.
Well, I think that there's a deeper purpose, is there not, for this?
Well, right. So we're using monkeys because they have very human-like arms, and they can participate in these kind of natural reaching tasks.
Yeah. Is it painful to the monkeys to have these implants?
Not really. Not at all. In fact, these implants are exactly what we use in humans, and the humans are comfortable with these.
Okay, yeah. I guess it's a good sign if you do these same experiments on people that you do on the animals. Yes. Let's take another call. This is John in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. There's a lot of talk and articles written about this that talk about how this could potentially benefit humans. My question is more about the monkeys. Do monkeys have a conscience? Is there anything we can learn about what's going on inside of the monkey's brain and possibly other animals? And, what could that potentially lead to?
Well, that's a good question. As we study movement and as it becomes more and more complex, we realize that a lot of these volitional movements are really the output of our intentions. And if you link intentions a little bit more, you start to get things like consciousness, decision-making, intention to move. And we are working toward that. Of course, it's pretty hard to assess consciousness in a monkey because we can't speak to them. But as these experiments progress to humans, I think we can really begin to attack some of these issues.
Hmm. So, yeah, I guess that would be interesting if you could actually get in and study that. But maybe not electrodes is probably – may not be the way to get into that sort of topic. So actually,
we are really interested in learning how these network properties produce things like learning and thinking and decision-making. So we're actually working real hard to understand how groups of neurons interact to produce this.
Yeah. And along those same lines, do you have any idea whether the monkeys perceive that the arm is moving as their own arm, or do they just sort of see it as a video game? Any way you can suss that out?
Well, we can't ask them, but what we see is that the monkeys seem to embody this device and that they do seem to consider it as part of their own body, or at least are very comfortable with it, because they do things like lick the hand when it has marshmallow residue, and they use the hand to shove food and rearrange it around inside their mouth, and they can stop and control it very easily.
Hmm. And what happens to their comparable arms when they're manipulating this robotic arm?
Well, we just have them gently restrained in some tubes along the side of their arms, and although the monkey may squirm a little bit to get comfortable as he's doing the task, most of the time he's pretty quiet and doesn't really try to move his arms.
So it's not the same exact electrical signals that they'd be using to try to move their actual
arms. No, it's pretty clear that they can dissociate driving their own arms from driving the robot arm.
Huh. Very good. Let's take one more call. This is Jason in Jason in Portland, Oregon. Jason, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question related to research that was done by Dr. Piotrowski back in the late 80s. I remember using electronics to control human muscles, and I was wondering if this had been thought of as a way to actually control muscles instead of robotic prosthesis.
Oh, exactly. Someday we'd like to be able to take this, and for instance, patients that are paralyzed, we'd like to reactivate their own muscles instead of having them use a prosthetic device. That turns out to be a bit more difficult of a control problem, but a lot of people are working on that right now.
Ah, that's fascinating. That would indeed be great. Well, thank you very much for coming in. We've run out of time, but it's a really interesting conversation. And as things progress, perhaps you can come back and give us an update.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Andrew Schwartz is professor of neurobiology at the University of Pittsburgh. And again, thanks for joining us. Up next, a look at the connection between women's reproductive rights and the environment. If the world's women had complete control over their reproduction, most of them would stop at just 2 or maybe 3 children. That's the premise of a new book, one that takes a long view on women's reproduction and the various forces that have, at different times in history, led women to have more or fewer children than they might otherwise have chosen. Joining me to talk about this is Robert Engelman. He is the author of More: Population, Nature, and What Women Want, just out by Island Press. He's also vice president for programs at the World Watch Institute, and he joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Thanks for talking with us, Mr. Engelman.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, Robert. Thank you. I should also mention that before you went to World Watch, you were vice president at a population organization, and I wonder if the inspiration for this book started from your many years of work of trying to think about world population.
Yeah, it had a lot to do with that. I spent 15 years with an organization called Population Action International and was lucky enough to travel a lot around the world, particularly in the developing world with that, and that's where I gathered quite a few of the stories that make up the book. Probably goes even before that. I was an environmental reporter for some time before I made the switch to getting active on some of these issues, and I was always intrigued by these connections even then.
Yeah. I should mention that callers are welcome to join in the conversation. Give us a jingle at 1-800-989-TALK and join the conversation with Robert Engelman. What inspired you to do this book? Did you start with a premise and then try to see if it panned out, or how did it come about?
Yeah, it was an exploration of a premise about contemporary affairs that actually in part brought me to the field, and my career for the last number of years has been an extended exploration of this really interesting premise about a topic that's pretty important in the world today, and it's in the news right now, but is also pretty sensitive and controversial, which is population growth and its impacts on environmental risk and other problems that people face. Right. And the premise is basically this. It was something I heard from a woman whom I eventually came to work with at PAI, the organization I worked in so many years, that if women were actually able to decide for themselves, not just what size family they wanted, but really at any given moment in their reproductive careers, do I want to be pregnant now, or would I rather not be pregnant now, wait for another time and not ever get pregnant ever, and could actualize their decisions free of pressure from husbands, mothers-in-law, churches, whatever. World population problems would pretty much resolve themselves in an environmentally sustainable way, and they'd take care of themselves. Well, I thought this was an interesting idea, and it actually became a topic of discussion at a UN conference in the mid-90s around population, which kind of made the assertion that, yes, the way to deal with population is to meet women's needs for reproductive health care and family planning. And it struck me in this conference in the mid-90s as something of an assertion that it didn't have a strong research base behind it. And I got interested in seeing if there was such a research base. Then I got intrigued because it's just the way my interests tend to run. And so how has this played out in history? What has this been true in the past? Have women, in fact, wanted to have smaller families or fairly a few children and weren't able to in the past? Or what have women's views been about these sorts of things? And that led me into a grand historical inquiry that pretty much took me back to the point at which humans became bipedal and started walking on 2 feet.
Indeed,
and then
yeah.
Led me forward from that.
Yeah. I'm Richard Harris, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking to Robert Engelman, author of More: Population, Nature, and What Women Want. And you mentioned that you started really way back in the beginning in this book and trying to understand, among other things, why the world population didn't grow much sooner, right? I mean, because we've had human career is pretty old, 200,000 years, something
That's
like
right.
that for, yeah. for us on the planet. Why is it only now that we seem to be facing a real population boom and obviously filling up the planet rather rapidly?
Yeah, and it is fairly recent, although it's happened at various points in the past on a smaller scale. This is really a story of how women saved humanity and how they could do it again if we just let them. That is, women were really the original population growers. They, because of various innovations that really belonged pretty much more securely to women than to men, particularly around the birth process itself, we can say pretty confident that if women hadn't been as strategic and successful at giving birth and raising children to adulthood as they had been, the human species would have went the way of most of the other hominid species and, in fact, most other animal species in the world and would have eventually gone extinct. Our great success was due, as any demographer knows, to the fact that women consistently, your maternal ancestors, Richard, as well as mine and everyone listening, gave birth to at least one and on average two and a bit more than two children and then successfully cleaned them, bathed them, kept them from falling into rivers, kept them away from where their lions hung out, so that they made it to their own reproductive age and then had children themselves. This is no small feat, and one of the things I looked into is, so how exactly did women do this in history, and why were Homo sapiens women so good at it, our mothers and grandmothers?
Right, and midwives tend to turn out to have a pretty important part in the story, don't they?
Well, this is a really interesting thing, and I really feel that very little attention has been given to the relationship between mothers and midwives. It was a revolution in animal behavior. Most animals give birth alone, and humans, for various reasons that are a little complicated to demonstrate on the radio, need help. It's very dangerous to give birth when you walk on 2 feet because of the way your pelvis is shaped, quite literally. You need help. And very early on, we can say, through logic and deduction more than fossil evidence, we don't have midwife fossils particularly, but we can figure, and people have worked this out pretty interestingly and well, that women had to get help from probably other women in giving birth, and that assisted birth itself was a tremendous spur to language, to communication, and to a whole way of raising children that was cooperative. It involved probably not just the mother, but a number of adults, the father too, I might add, but probably especially grandmothers and cooperating women to bring children to adulthood.
Hmm.
Now, to get back to your question about population growth, the other side of this question that's interesting is that it's not hard to document that throughout human history, or for certainly quite a long time, women have also been interested in the other side of this. It's very important to have enough children survive, as Margaret Mead pointed out long ago. It becomes difficult if too many consistently do, because then suddenly your population grows rapidly and you run a little short on resources. And women tended to be acutely aware of that, and the evidence is very strong, and the documentation, even historically, is strong, that for a very long time they have sought to find methods and substances that could help them be sexually active, but only become pregnant when they wanted to do so. And they've been frustrated by that, in some cases, by men, for interesting reasons that relate to our social development over the years. And that frustration is probably one of the major reasons that populations have grown as much as they have over the years.
Huh. Well, we'll be right back after this short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're talking this hour about reproduction and the environment with my guest, Robert Engelman, who's written a book called More: Population, Nature, and What Women Want. He's also vice president for programs at the World Watch Institute. And we were talking about not only having more babies, but also figuring out ways to have fewer babies. And I was surprised to read in your book about how early there were, at least reportedly, herbal contraceptives and things like that. Do you have any idea? Well, tell me about them. And do you think any of them were actually effective?
Well, about as early as there's writing, there's mention of the idea of contraception. Egyptian hieroglyphics talk about using crocodile dung. I'm not quite sure how or how effective that would be. And there's varying opinions about this, Richard. There certainly are some views that, well, these were some kind of herbs you ate. It was pretty hard to invent the oral contraceptive pill and took a lot of testing and a lot of work. It'd be pretty surprising if you could just eat a piece of fruit and it would be as effective as the pill. And I think that's a point well taken. These were not what, I say in the book, don't try these at home, readers. But interestingly, they have been studied by historical pharmacologists, and many of the herbs, particularly that are mentioned in, for example, classical Greek literature. Pomegranates feature in the myth of Persephone, for example, and Demeter. Have been found to have these interesting hormonal or estrogenic, or they mimic estrogenic kinds of qualities, and it leads some pharmacologists to think they might have had some effect. And the interesting thing is, from your own personal perspective, you wouldn't want something that might have some effect, but from a demographic perspective, if people were using these in widespread ways, you don't have to bend down the arc of fertility very much to actually have a big impact over time on demographic change.
I suppose if enough women are taking them.
That's right. And by some theories in some populations, Europe, for example, in the Middle Ages, they may have been quite widely used. There are also other things that can be effective if they're used. Withdrawal, for example, which you get a nice lesson about by reading Genesis. And withdrawal can be relatively effective if it's used consistently. It's not a woman-controlled method. That's kind of a problem. But under certain circumstances, it can be and probably has been used to reduce unwanted pregnancies in the past.
Yeah. One theme of your book seems to be that men want more kids and women want fewer kids. Is there an explanation for that?
Yeah. And it's a generalism. I wouldn't say it's true in every case, and I don't want to criticize men too much in this regard. But yeah, men and women are different in the way they have children. This is the one way that I think we can all agree that men and women are genuinely, without any controversy, different. Women give birth to all babies, at least last time I checked the data, and men have a lot to do with that, but they don't give birth. And they have a bit of a different interest about it, and it's evolved to actually bifurcate to some degree, and that probably in early days men shared many of women's interests in not having too many children in the tribe or the clan or the family for environmental reasons. But as societies developed, men began to recognize the importance of having lots of soldiers, lots of people to build pyramids, lots of farmers for food surpluses, while women were continuing to think, is it safe for me to have a child? Will it be safe for my child? Will my child grow up and become an adult and have children of her own? So there's this different view that's quite borne out in the anthropological and sociological literature as well. Men typically, for example, tell survey researchers that they would like to have more women than their spouses are reporting to the same survey researchers
that's
or partners.
Huh. Let's go to the phones. Let's hear from Vince in Rockford, Illinois. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yes. This has been a sort of a frightening subject for me ever since reading Paul Ehrlich's Population Bomb about 1970. And I'm just wondering if we're past the point where certain resources, I mean, oil is all over the news these days, but, you know, fresh water and other such resources for growing food, are we past the point of being able to support ourselves even if the population birth rate were to drop to zero at this point?
Well, let's hope it's not going to drop to zero. And it's a good question. I think it's fundamentally unanswerable, Vince. My sense about it is, I guess the best answer I can give you is that, yeah, it's possible. We may be. We don't really know. The book comes out at a pretty good time because of the concern about rising food prices, rising energy prices. Not a good time in the sense that I'm happy about that, obviously. But these issues are getting more attention. I chose in part because of the attention Ehrlich got for his book and the sort of the history of writing about population, not to dwell on, is it too late? Are we past the point of no return with human population? But to focus, again, looking at the long term, on the fact that we have had population pressures in the past. We are very innovative as a species. We often find ways to address them. We have a good record of survival for the 200,000 years that Richard mentioned. So I prefer to be optimistic and look at the idea that if women are able to make decisions about their own childbearing, hopefully with their partners, but if not with their partners, on their own, that we can, and if we do all the other right things, we clearly have to do a lot that doesn't have anything to do with population, saving energy and being more penurious about our use of resources and being fairer with poor people and people who don't consume as much as wealthy people. All of these things have to be done in concert. And then I'm hopeful that we'll find out we haven't overshot. But we're in a pretty dangerous zone right now. I would agree with that.
Yeah. I guess one of the issues is that people think personally about how many kids do I want, and one kid is not going to make a difference to whether the world runs out of resources or not. So it's a difficult juxtaposition of personal views versus global views. And I think you saw that replicated also in the debate about population. As you mentioned, up until about the early 90s, everyone was concerned about world population. And then the discussion very much shifted to personal issues and hasn't really come back full circle, I would guess, to the question about what are these numbers all adding up to?
Yeah, and there's a real strong sense, and I think it's understandable and in many, many ways justifiable, that people shouldn't be telling other people how to make these decisions for themselves. There's a great discomfort with that. And one of the most encouraging things I discovered in researching this is that there's a kind of invisible hand that relates to personal well-being and connects it to collective and species-wide well-being. That is, women, when they're making decisions about when to be pregnant and when not to be, they aren't really thinking about global warming or whether there's enough water. I mean, they may be, but that's probably the exception. They're more thinking about, what about me? What about my partner? What about this child? But collectively, these decisions through history have tended to make population more sustainable when they can be put into effect. When they can't be put into effect, population tends to be less sustainable.
Yeah. Let's take another call. This is Jonathan in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for taking my call. I was just discussing this very topic with my class today. What effect has the Mexico City policy or the international gag rule had on the fertility rates and environmental damage in second and third world countries? And I'll take my question off here. Thank you very much for your time.
Could you explain what that is?
Yeah, it's a great question. It gets into the policy wonk side of me, but it is represented a little bit in the book. The Mexico City policy is a policy that Republican presidents and not Democratic presidents since 1984 have had an effect that dictates that U.S. foreign assistance for family planning and reproductive health care generally can never be given to any organization, any non-governmental organization at least, that ever mentions the word abortion, even if in response to a woman's question about abortion and whether it's, say, legal in her country or whatever, and certainly not if they offer abortions. And it's had the effect of limiting U.S. assistance to some of the better, more comprehensive reproductive health organizations around the world, groups like Planned Parenthood or Mari Stopes International out of Britain. And I don't think that there's a way to draw a direct connection to how much environmental damage it may have caused or even how much where fertility is because of it. But it's very clear to people who work in the field that it is much harder to provide good services to women who are asking for them as a result of this restriction. The U.S. is the biggest single donor in this field. And when it tells half to two-thirds of the talented people that work in this area, we can't help you because you occasionally mention the word abortion, obviously the care that real women receive goes way down. And PAI, which the organization I used to work for, documented numerous clinics that had to shutter their doors. Some of them were offering HIV prevention and treatment, had to close their doors because of this policy. So it's a tragic policy, and hopefully it will be reversed soon.
Yeah, and you mentioned several times in the book that abortion is unfortunately something that we can't ignore, that it has to be part of the formula. Why do you say that?
Well, it's ubiquitous in human history, and it's ubiquitous in society. It's everywhere because contraception doesn't always succeed. There's been no society that's eradicated. It exists under every religion. And it's critical, especially because the lack of safe access to abortion has been so murderous to women. I document some of the things that happen when women try to get abortions that aren't legal and therefore generally aren't safe. And women are very often driven to this, and they've been driven to it in the past. What happens often with the lack of abortion is that you find something that I would argue is much, much worse, which is higher levels of infanticide, and that can be documented as well.
Yes, you talked about that quite a bit through history. That appeared to be a method of population control.
Yeah, infanticide is interesting and obviously sad. And one of the main points about infanticide, which has been a method of a kind of fertility control or a way for women to avoid the commitment to being a parent, is that even aside from the attachment you might have in giving birth and have to break when you cause your child to lose its life, it's a horrific, bad investment in reproduction. You have to go through all the dangers of pregnancy and childbirth, which have been historically and still are quite dangerous to very many women around the world. you obviously wouldn't do it if you had the choice of safe and effective contraception. And I think that can be said throughout history, that of all the infanticide that's existed in history, it was because there were not safe and effective contraceptive options. We live in a world now where we have those. There's no reason for infanticide to exist in this world.
Let's hear from Katie in Dos Palos, California, is it?
Yes. Hi. I am a veterinarian who works in population control, you could say. And my question relates to, well, I guess somewhat related to the infanticide option, which is that we have, as veterinarians, very often been forced to deal with overpopulation of pets by euthanasia of either infant or post-infant animals. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on the relationship between our finding in animals that when the population tends to be limited, the quality of life for all of the animals that are brought into the world tends to go up, and that the fewer surplus animals there are due to unplanned birth, the better quality of life the animals that are brought into the world tend to enjoy.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks. It's an opportunity to plug the website for my book, morethebook.org, where I have some blogs. And in there's a blog about veterinarians and animals and euthanasia. My wife and I recently had to go through the sad experience of sitting with our cat while a veterinarian put our cat to sleep. And so it caused me to ruminate on cats and actually the impact that cats have on songbirds, which I suspect Richard is familiar with and maybe done stories on. And this does relate very much to human population. Now, relative to your direct point, I would want to be very careful about talking about using the word surplus when we discuss humanity. It's not a word that I'm very comfortable with in talking about people. Can be perhaps used in discussing animals. But a point that I would make about our pets and our livestock is that these animals, much as we love them and are grateful for them, and my wife and I really loved our cat, are now getting in an unbalanced situation because of the large numbers of humans in the world. And they actually outnumber wild animals by very large ratios, which I discuss in the book. Yeah. And it's because of human population, of course. So they're having their own environmental impacts, such as threatening the survival of songbird species. Cats like to kill birds.
I'm Richard Harris, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So we're talking to Robert Engelman about his new book called More, and it has to do with women and their role in controlling human population or determining what it will be and what effect it has on the environment. And let's go back to the phones. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, and let's talk to Russ in Kansas City.
Hello there. My assertion would be that not only must women have control of their reproductive rights, but they must have a certain degree of education in order to exercise that control.
Absolutely.
I know somebody whose husband got a vasectomy and she promptly divorced him because she felt she should pop out puppies every 9 months. Unfortunately, there are a number of the more the merrier cults, I'll call them. I won't mention names specifically, but unfortunately, they tend to believe that, and their members tend to believe that reproduction should be, well, you know, go be fruitful and multiply. That may have applied back when you could shoot another Indian and get another acre, but not so much anymore. What I'm trying to get at is, for instance, certain streams of Christianity, they take their holy book. I'm not Christian personally, but they take it as a kind of a salad menu. They take some items, they leave others. For instance,
yeah,
you know, homosexuality is evil, but wearing mixed fiber and eating shellfish isn't, that sort of thing.
Yeah, okay. Now, that you do talk a bit about the role of the church in the course of human history here. Do you want to say just a couple words about that before we wrap up?
Yeah, there's a whole chapter about the development of a period in history when most of the world's great religions had their roots, and it was a period of pretty intense female subjugation and a sense that it was important to have lots of children in part to spread the faith. And I do discuss that a fair amount. What I would say here, to be brief, because we are running out of time, is that where that's really been a problem, I mean, everyone is entitled to their views and their religious views and their views about reproduction. Where it's been a particular problem is where institutions, religious or otherwise, have felt that they should impose their views on everybody else and on women in particular. And where that's occurred, you've had real problems. You've had a kind of perverse reverse population control. And most population control historically has induced women to have more children than they would have had had they been free to decide. The sense I came out of with the, through the research was that everyone's entitled to their opinion and everyone's entitled to their religious views. The key point is that when women decide on their own individually, in the silence of their own mind, whether this is the time to become pregnant or this is not the time to become pregnant, and they have safe, healthy, effective ways to put that decision into effect, things go well. When other people are telling them, you got to have this many kids, things go badly.
Hmm. Well, on that note, I would like to thank you very much. Robert Engelman is author of More, Population, Nature, and What Women Want. He's also vice president for programs at the World Watch Institute. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Richard.
The program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Schumann Ma is our Metcalf fellow. Our intern is Christopher Intagliata. Josh Rogerson is our technical director, and he's at the controls here in New York. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. I'm Richard Harris. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be back next week.